fresh off the airplane and back in my apartment in Los Angeles from Costa Rica, in-person edition of Advantage Connors. But I'm here with just Jimmy. How are you, Pops?
Oh, I've made the trip south.
Yes.
You know, from Santa Barbara now to come down and to hang out with you in your place. Mm-hmm. But you know who's hanging around L.A.? You know, our friend of the podcast, Spencer Segura. Once again,
multiple time guest.
Yeah. You know, just says that, hey, if you want some excitement, get me on there. So now you're on.
I got nothing to lose. I can say anything I want.
So we're supposed to be on a couple weeks ago. We teased it.
But
then some shoulder injuries came up. You had to get a surgery. You had the
rotator cuff rager surgery. Rebuilt my whole shoulder. 4 hours under Dr. John Itamura from the famous Curlin Job. Fantastic doctor.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, it's been a couple of weeks. How are you feeling now?
Better. I tell you, the one thing that was interesting, which I think everybody in sports should know, they don't have anything for pain, and they only have opioids. So you get your operation, and then they give you opioids, but they're scared now to give them to you because of the addiction.
Right.
And I'll give you the other big secret, constipation. And there's one other thing, and they don't work great. And so I was like so wired from the operation, and then I start the opioids, and I'm like, I was screwed up for a week at least. And
that's when we were actually hoping to get you on.
Yeah.
Because then we know your guard's down. We'll get you saying anything.
Yeah. I would have said anything. Anyway, then I got on some steroids, which made me like, was that the guy from the Raiders that killed five people? No, I was like crazy with the steroids, but that got me the inflammation down. And then, so now I'm back. I'm coming back. I'm making a comeback.
Nice. I like that. You got to get the rehab going. You'll be back on the tennis court soon.
Yeah. Oh man, that's going to be dangerous.
Yeah.
But you're back. You've had 2 weeks away in Costa Rica.
Had to pull me back.
On our last podcast, you were in the jungle.
Right.
And then you were there for 6 days or so, and then you made a trip to the beach. Tell me about that.
Yep, jungle first half, and then we went to the beach. That was the golf part of the trip. Brought the sticks. Had to played 3 days of golf.
Nice.
A nice little 18-hole course right there. No one else out there. So it was like my own course. And then we were staying at this cool place by the beach.
Mm-hmm.
So beautiful beach. And my favorite part of the whole trip was the animal life. So there's monkeys. There's these howler monkeys in the trees. There's these, I forget what they're called, white noise copamundis. Cutamundis, I think. They look like little raccoon dogs, and they're everywhere. They're super friendly. There's iguanas that are like 3-4 feet long.
Right.
You know, there's birds. There's all kinds of stuff. And
what's your favorite on the whole trip was what? What animal?
The sloth.
Yeah,
by far. The first half we had a sloth kind of like preserve where they're like protected in this area, and got to see three sloths. Highlight of the whole trip, we're sitting in this hot like spring because it's heated by the volcano, right? So they got these like hot springs. Sitting in it, it starts pouring rain because every couple of days it would come in rain, like Florida where it comes in and cleans everything out. And then it's nice. Sitting there and I'm like, man, I really wish we could see another sloth. You know, we've seen the one, he's always sleeping, you know, they're not moving. And literally 30 seconds later, I'm staring off. And there's a sloth moving his way from one tree to the next tree.
Wow.
Slowly. It looks like it's in slow motion, but we sat there for 30 minutes in the rain watching the sloth climb the tree. It was like the coolest part of the trip for me.
You didn't want to come home, did you?
No, I did not. I wanted to see you guys. I miss Bella. Thank you for bringing her back. She was happy to see us.
Yes, she was.
But yeah, happy to be back with you guys to talk a little tennis and catch up. Spence, it's been a while.
Yeah, it has. We've had some great tennis, though. We've had Madrid, Monte Carlo, Barcelona.
Right.
I think Hamburg. And so
clay court
good tennis. Good clay.
The clay court.
It's all clay, except when you get to Madrid, I think it's a different court than the regular, you know, European clay. There's altitude. And I lost in the qualifying there. I remembered playing there. It was extremely difficult to stand up for a California hardcore player. And so I think you see a lot of injuries, which is consistent with you slide, but it's extremely slippery. It's like a hard surface under a sandy surface
right.
And with the altitude, but it's a hell of a tournament. It was fun to watch. And
I played the tournament also in the day and you know the court you know what it would start out one way and it would dry out you know become a little tougher. This was back in the day,
you
know, a little different now maybe, but So I went over there and I played one time, and Manolo Santana, a friend, great friend of your dad's and yours, and I met him, you know, through you and your dad also, was, you know, paid me a very nice size guarantee to come over there one time.
Knowing you, that had to be a very big guarantee.
And I lose the first set to a South American clay court specialist, a grinder.
Oh, Jesus.
And the court all starts drying out. So, you know, I come through and I win the second set, and I'm on a roll.
Yeah.
As we change sides, I'm waiting and I'm tiling off and getting ready to start the third set, and I'm walking out, and all of a sudden, you know, the groundskeeper with the hose, you know, comes and pours gallons of water on the court and turns it back into a mud bowl.
Wow. God.
And I'm looking and I'm going, Holy shit, what's wrong with this picture? You know, I was on a roll, you know, now I'm back into a grind and everything. And I remember telling Manolo, I said, Manolo, you paid me a big, big price to come here. I said, you know, get the fan and dry this thing out for me. You know, but I actually ended up losing the match. And
you lost the match?
Yeah, I did. I lost the match.
Out of spite?
But that show, I don't think Jimbo probably got there a week before, and now I don't think so.
Right. And the late arrival,
and it's a totally different court than Monte Carlo,
right?
So that can happen.
Shout out. It's an interesting. Or back then, and I'm sure it's the same now. Yeah. But the way the ball travels through the air, you know, and you know, for those who don't know that, you know, in altitude, you know, how the ball travels through the air, and it's a little tougher to control.
Right.
You know, do you string your rackets a little tighter? Are they a little looser? You know, or you know, with this new string that they have, you know, how do you handle that?
Yeah.
You know, so. It's very interesting, but you've talked about they had Monte Carlo, they had Barcelona, Madrid, and Hamburg, you know, the clay court season is long.
Yeah.
You know, they have, I think, three or four more tournaments, and that's including the French. So that's another, you know, 5 or 6 weeks of clay court tennis. That's a long clay court season.
And then they go back to it after the grass. There's like another little clay court that they go in. You know, half the tour will go hard court to America, kind of, and some people go play some of the clay court. And you're right, it's tough. Like when we work the clay court matches, it's a grind. You can tell they're longer points, longer breaks in between. They give them a little more, you know, room to towel off and that kind of stuff. And do you think it's leading to some of this, like the injuries? Because like we've seen, with Madrid, you got Carlos is pulled out of Rome next week.
Right.
Sinner's pulled out of Rome. Those are the top two seeds in
Rome.
Madrid.
That's a great tournament.
It's a great tournament. And then, you know, Sinner's Italian.
I think you had three I remember Bournemouth, that tournament in England. I was on that red brick chip kind of court.
That's right.
This court is not that bad, but it's similar. And then you had Stad or Kitz, one of those. It was like a brick on top of brick chips on top.
Bostad.
You can get hurt in easy. Sweden. And these tall, Sinner's tall, standing back, trying to torque. He probably tweaked his hip.
When you're always pushing off the hips.
Because you're not standing. Right, you know? You're not really, unless you're like Alcaraz and guys like Rudd, that, you know, they got, they can play on any of these cards. Mm-hmm. I think it's an unstable foundation for these big guys to be trying to nail the ball, and so they can get hurt easy.
You're just coming off shoulder surgery, and you can testify to what it takes to go through that. It's no easy thing to go through.
Yeah.
And you know, in our day when we played, it seems that most of the injuries are below the waist.
Yeah.
You know, ankles or knees or.
But nobody really got hurt bad until they're older too.
Well, that's actually a good point.
Of the guys.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's a good point,
especially the guys who played with their whole full turn, you know, with a pivot, you know, not just arming the ball. If you turn to the side, you can open stance, but if you turned and pivoted, you're not putting the strain on one body part as much as some of these guys on the higher ball, bouncing higher ball, they can just
open up
and torque the arm. Well,
But then you're putting all that,
you're putting all that stress
on the top part of your body.
Your wrist, the shoulder.
You know, and that's what Alcaraz has. Yeah. He has an arm, it seems like.
Yeah, he's a tremendously talented, different type of talent. He's an unusual player because he has so much of... He changes a grip on the forehand for a drop shot. I watch him. He has the wrist up, the hand up, and then he's changing grips. He's doing lots of stuff that very few people can do.
And his drop shot is already amazing.
And he's drop shotting standing straight up from the baseline.
Right.
No one in history ever drop shotted without being down low.
Right.
Because you wanted, if you drop shot standing up, the ball bounced. Our ball that we played didn't bounce like these guys, but because so these guys didn't stand so far back either.
Right.
These guys are at the back of the fence, and he comes up and drops it. He's got the flexibility. He serves. By the way, he served really well in Madrid to the body. Again, I watched him play the German kid.
Struffy.
It was a hell of a match. Served the body every second serve. Struffy never figured it out. Got caught trying to hit backhands on the first point, like inside out. Mm-hmm. He moves up, puts away a forehand, or he drops it. That's what Sinner needs to do. But he's doing everything right. He just maybe doesn't have the power that a guy like Sinner has.
You know? Right. But Sinner's gotten better with like his serve.
Yeah.
I feel like he comes to net a little bit
he's
more.
He's got the big game. He's got with his serve. We talked about it last time he played Djokovic. That was Jimmy Bo gave me seats to sit at Wimbledon and I watched Djokovic Sinner. Sinner was up, I think, 2-1. Mm-hmm. Didn't make one first serve the whole match and was beating Djokovic. Mm-hmm. And Djokovic's not missing a single return. Mm-hmm. And I knew, I said, if Sinner ever learns how to hit a first serve, he's got the game to beat Djokovic because he was hitting the ball so deep. And Djokovic's forehand, particularly, which has improved, mm-hmm. was short compared to Sinner's.
Right.
And Sinner was able to out-hit him from the baseline, basically. And so once this guy learns how to punish you when he makes the first serve, as opposed to get into a point with you, mm-hmm. every time he's up 30 love, if he hits a big serve, he should pick the point on the rise and finish the point, mm-hmm. even if he loses the point. Right. He's up 30 love.
Go for it.
If he does that.
Just to what? Just to get it in the opponent's mind.
Get in the opponent's mind and get ahead without having to rally. And right. Why rally? He's up 30 love.
Free points.
And he's got a monster serve, Jimbo. Yeah. If he hits it in, he's got a big first serve. That Alcaraz doesn't have, but he's doing it. Mm-hmm. He's playing the way a Sinner should.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Brett.
No, go ahead.
But isn't that the way it normally goes, though? I mean, you know, if Alcaraz, for instance, had a serve as big as Sinner's, his forehand and his the rest of his game, his movement and everything might not be so good. You know,
right, but you're right. But I mean, you didn't have a huge serve, but if a guy hits short on you and you're up 30 love, you're going to be in on him. Most of the time, you were going to hit an approach shot or a shot that pulled him off the court. Am I wrong with that?
No, you're right. But
it would be so easy to improve Sinner. Where you were just talking how many matches Jimbo always won. You know, he routined these matches that everybody goes, he gets to the quarters every time he plays. He doesn't even have to practice. He's in the semis before. You know, this guy should be in the semis every tournament.
Yeah.
Without even, because of this huge game that he's got.
Well, since like October of last year, he has.
Yeah. But he's taking a toll. He's hurt now. He rallies out. He doesn't want to be Del Potro, okay? You're not going to hit five of the biggest forehands in the history of the game in one point and Nadal still be in the point with you. He has to stop that kind of game. And that's his next level to improve and be volleying those shots. When he's up, it's all about the score.
Definitely.
The Jimbo can tell you. It's all about if you're ahead, you know.
When I think he's had issues in the past with, you know, people – you know, saying, you know, does he have the physicalness to go deep in these longer events? And he's had to withdraw and then, you know, now he's been proving a lot of those people wrong. But there was a graphic Tennis Channel did, and it's talked about he had won 25 of his first 26 matches on the year. And he was one of like six people who had done it. One of them I'm sitting with here, done it four times, you know,
thank you.
and he did it. So that's obviously the most tennis he's ever played at this point in the year.
Right.
Cause he's already got two or three titles. I think he won Australia, he won Rotterdam. And so, you know, is that just starting to take a little toll? Like his body's not used to it. And then he gets on the clay and it, you know, it's harder on your body. It's, you know, it's a grind even more, you know? And so it's just, I don't know.
Yeah, movement's different.
Yeah.
You know, the way you expect the ball to come through the court a little bit is different than hard courts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of things that affect, you know, a change of surface. You know, not so much the way the ball bounces anymore, but the way, you know, the individual, you know, figures out a way to make his game the best it can be. On the courts.
I don't know who's pulling.
That's you.
I'll turn it off. Turn it off. Okay, sorry about that. That's not Bonkon.
Take it.
Okay.
Take it. It's all right.
Hey, Tony.
I can edit it out.
Spencer. 5:30 bar. Okay.
Shout out non-BonCon.
Yeah. going back to movement, you know, from hard courts to clay, you know, and the way you have to figure that out, that's the practice.
Yeah.
You know, that I would try to get my mind more around was the way I moved, because, you know, my movement was what set me up for my shots, you know, the way I played. So, you know, these guys are big now,
right?
You know, most of the players, back in my era, you know, were 6 feet or under,
right?
You know, now they're, you know, well over 6 feet. And it's, you know, you're carrying around a big frame, you know, which, you know, which can take its toll on you.
I think the ball being so much higher, bouncing means that, you have a lot more time. On the one hand, it's easier because when we played, the low ball is what killed you. Right. The low skidding ball that moved you, you couldn't get under. And that's why they used to say, oh, you have too much topspin. Well, you could, because the guy had so much topspin, he couldn't get under the ball. And he set the ball up for you to hit the ball down on him. Today, it's the reverse. The high ball is the way everybody plays. So you're having longer points. Because I hate to say it, anybody can hit a high ball. I mean, and all these guys hit great ground strokes. So you're hitting a million ground strokes on high balls. So,
which is different in the past, where you're not having to be up here whipping, you were down here more.
And I would say that's more of a younger man's game in a way, because it's more baseline, more of rallies, if that's what you like to look at, like ping pong, if that's sort of what it's become. But now I see these guys like Sinner who have the big first serve as well as the big round, flatter. They're not playing like Ruud or like Zarev or like they got a game that can push through you, like the old style game. Now, if they start to really play that old style game with the score their way, not all the time, you know, defensive and offensive, like he's talking about with Alcaraz, as a guy who's got both games, a guy like this guy has the big game, Sinner. I mean, he has the game that he could maybe dominate if he finishes that last part of the court, the inside the service box. Approach shots, coming in, close out the points when you're up. And, and
Bretter, I mean, you watch so much tennis, and you see, I mean, on the clay, no matter who's playing, you know, when you go and do the matches, you settle in.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you have to.
I mean, there's no matches that that go quick.
No. And then, I mean, besides the surface making the matches longer, what do you guys think about the actual, like, equipment? You guys talked about the rackets and the strings a little bit, but the ball itself, we've talked about it. Everyone talks about it. It's different balls every week. Different tournaments have different balls, different contracts with different ball companies. And they say that the ball, like back when you guys played, it took a little while when you would rally for the ball to kind of fluff itself up.
Right.
A good while. Yeah.
Now it's like two or three, like, rallies.
Games,
Right, like a game or something, and it's fluffed up. It looks like a beach ball. And it's like, in a way, that's good. Like, wow, I can see it's bigger, but then it's wearing out the shoulders. Yeah. It's wearing out the elbows and the arms, you know, and it's making it more difficult. And then if they're promoting longer play like they are, like you guys have said, with the homogenizing of the surfaces, it seems like it's all adding together to, like, beat these guys up more.
Well, you're seeing that,
you
know, with the way the guys are getting hurt. Yeah. You know, and if they're playing three tournaments in a row, four tournaments in a row, especially, you know, I can't say especially on the clay, because it's the same on the hard courts. The balls fluff up there too. So, you know, if you're playing, you know, three, four tournaments in a row, and you're getting to the semis and the finals every week, you know, it does take its toll on you physically.
Yeah.
And then. Once you feel that twinge, or once you think you're getting hurt, or once you think you're wearing out or getting tired or whatever, then it plays on you mentally too.
Yeah.
You know, so then
it's, you're thinking about
then way too much.
Look at Federer. He was content trying to hit backhand passing shots, winners down the line in the old days. And then all of a sudden, as he got older, he starts moving in and chipping and coming in behind balls. Remember, it's sort of the last 4 years of his career.
Even Djokovic or Nadal. You look at him the first half to now, especially when they're on the grass. Yeah. But they come to net. They realize, like, look, I can't keep grinding. You know, I'm getting older. I don't want to put all the miles on when I, you know, don't have to.
Yeah.
Necessarily.
Yeah.
But, you know, I go back at the end. I knew what it was like, you know, because there was a certain time where, I mean, I could almost say it to the minute. Yeah, you know, where I said, here it comes.
I'm coming. I'm not going to rally with this.
Right. You know, it's coming, you know, because it does. It just wears you out, especially, you know, these guys, you know, Sinner's young.
Yeah.
Nadal's not, you know, Joker's not now. I mean, it's a fact.
Yeah.
You know, we have to look at it that way. And to figure out a way, you know, to shorten the points, you know, even, you know, it's like Spencer said, even if you lose it.
Yeah. If you're up, at least you're
moving forward and you're getting it in your mind that, you know, hey, you're going to have to pass me 40 times.
Yeah. Right.
You know, if you're going to win this set.
And or, you know, you're good enough as a player to where the tactic's going to work 50% of the time. And if you're doing it at 30 love.
But why is it rocket science? I mean, Jimmy knows how to do it. My dad, all those great, all the, they all knew how to play the score. And you see guys like Medvedev standing back at the fence, playing Nadal, a lefty, and standing back at the fence and putting the ball in play. And then the guy's got the lefty forehand to pull him right off the court. I mean, what's he thinking? Yeah. I mean, why wouldn't he change the way he plays? Then I watch Alcaraz. He does change. He moves up. He's returning inside the baseline sometimes now. I love to see that. I'd like to see more of that. And I think that was what would make the game more exciting, because you're going to have more inside the court than just run back to the baseline, run behind the baseline like Rude or like Zverev, who's also got a huge game.
Right.
Could be a much better player also.
And then in reality, most of the points usually end up finishing in that part of the court.
Yeah.
It's just they might rally for 10 or 20 balls, and then someone gets a short ball, and bang, 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 here we go. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
But, I mean, speaking of injuries, like Felix plays Rublev in the finals, right? He's playing him.
Right.
Felix has had, he played Jakub Mensik, had to retire mid-match. Then he beat Rude.
Yeah.
Might have been a little tired just because he won Barcelona, made the finals Monte Carlo. Still a good win.
Yeah.
Then Sinner gives him a walkover. Then he plays Lehecka in the semis, and Lehecka retires at 3-3. So literally the guy who's in the finals, you know, of Madrid, you know, had three injury, you know, kind of helps to get him there.
Yeah, so is that a dream tournament? I don't think so.
No. I mean, he'll take it.
Yeah, you'll take it.
But it's got to be tough for the rhythm. Like, you know, now you play Rublev, you know, and it's a...
It might also show you how much stronger Nadal was than all these guys for the last... For 8 years, he's been in the final how many times, and he never gets hurt.
Right, right.
Yeah. Now he's hurt, but I mean, you know, he's old.
Yeah. What did you think about that? I mean, he got lost to Demonauer and then beat him in this tournament, and then ended up losing to Lehecka.
I don't think it matters what he does now. I mean, what does he care? I mean, he loves tennis. He's a big fan in Spain. I mean, he's a big fan. He's a great champion. I don't think he has anything to prove.
So. No, not at all.
It's just if he likes to play, let him play.
Mm-hmm.
It's great for the crowd.
But it's interesting. And we talked about this, Brad. It's tough to go.
Right.
It's tough to let that go. Yeah. You know, it's been his life.
Yeah.
You know, to this point, and he's, you know, from when he first picked up a racket to train and find something that he liked to do and that he loved to do, and then he became good at it, and then all of a sudden he becomes a superstar in it, you know, and adulation and that pat on the back and, you know, the superstar and, you know, and all
well,
that.
Well, I think it's probably like it's same
to,
for you, Jim.
Tough to let go.
It's hard to accept to lose to somebody you know you're way better than.
Right.
And that's what probably he had. This guy, whatever was the check, he's good. He's going to be a hell of a tennis player. He's not Nadal.
No,
okay.
Right.
And so Nadal's probably gritting his teeth going, oh, God, I got to... And loses.
Right.
And so,
I feel like Murray does that a lot. Like Murray still goes out there,
yeah.
and I'm sure he walks off the court going, like, if I just had my other hip, like I'd beat that guy at straights. You know?
Maybe, but he never achieved what Nadal did.
No, no. But I mean, it's like I get that same feeling where like Murray loses to some guys where like he knows he's better than, but it's just his body's giving out.
Right. Well, that's life.
Right. I saw something that we could all relate to. I saw Nadal said he wants to keep playing so that his son can watch him play because he's got a really young son, he's less than a year old, I think. And they showed pictures of his wife, and the son sitting there courtside, cute little guy. And that makes sense because I remember how much fun it was being able. You played so long, I was able to be a part of a lot of it. You know, I mean, I came on tour with you till 1992 or 1993, and then we played like we talked about a couple weeks ago, Halle in 1995.
Right.
You know, you were like 43. I was like 15 years old.
Right.
Coming with you, hanging out, we're playing golf at the 9-hole course across the street.
So you got to see your dad play, like that's good. I saw my dad play too. I was 8 years old, and he won a big tournament in L.A. I got to see him play everybody, Gonzalez, Hoad, Rosewall, Sedgman, day in, day out. And that was like so exciting to see her again. It's nerve-wracking, but exciting.
Yeah, definitely nerve-wracking. Yeah. But those memories are so cool. You know, when you're young, you kind of don't get it. But then as you get older, you realize how lucky we were to have those times.
Yeah.
Well, you know, traveling, and he's, I had you younger.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, that's true.
And he's, you know, 37 and You know, I mean, if he's going to do that, he's going to have to play another 4 or 5 years. Maybe,
right.
You know,
yeah,
maybe.
I don't know if he's going to do that.
Don't know if he wants to put himself through that. You know, I understand his feeling for that, because that was important to me, that, you know, even on the senior tour, you know, that your sister would go, and your mom. And that was important. That's a feeling that everything that you've accomplished, that's just the icing on the cake. But on the other hand, for him, that's going to be a long road to hoe, to try to especially keep up at the level that he's expected to play. I said that wrong. That he expects himself to play.
Right,
right.
That's going to be a tough push for him.
So, Jimbo, is it tough? Like, you're playing a guy, let's say the guy's hitting the ball back to you're in the point, and he starts to overpower you because he's physically, he's in better shape. How am I losing it? But the guy's, he's hitting through me in some, like, I saw it a little bit with Sinner and Djokovic at Wimbledon, where your guy hits through you, you know, and he's hitting the ball. You're hitting the ball deep. You're having great points. He's hitting the ball a little too tough.
It's just too
and
much.
And then with age, you start to, there's a
lose
moment.
Lose things.
Yeah, you start, yes, and yeah. you start, you're losing it, and you start to see that. And that's, I think, you know, I don't know if Nadal beat a lot of guys in Madrid with nothing, not playing. He didn't have to play even well. Then he plays this one guy, play well. I think Nadal still could play a little better. I think he's improving still right now. So he's going to have in his mind, I can play better than this. So maybe he's going to keep playing.
And Madrid's his worst. To be honest, Madrid's his like worst clay court tournament. Okay. He's only won it, I think, 3 or 4 times. You know, the other ones, he's got double digits.
It's fast,
right,
it's fast.
The altitude and it's fast. It's a little different style.
So he'll be better at the French. He'll be better.
Listen, the game's better with him in it.
Yeah.
It's so much better.
Yeah.
And it creates, you know, so many talking points.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's talking that he's too old, that right. he's not what he used to be, and listen, it's like the old gray mare.
You ain't.
You're not, and if you're expected to, then that's not fair.
Yeah.
But you know, for him, for me, the way he always approached his matches and went out there, he was all business, and the attitude that he had, and the grit and the grind, never let a ball go,
run down every ball,
run down everything, kill himself, and leave his DNA out there, and he's left plenty of that, around the world. So I keep going back that we could sit here and talk about it, forever, but it's ultimately his decision, and eventually, we all get it. Right. Everybody gets it.
Yeah.
Then you just, have so many other things to do the rest of your life that you just kind of fall into that.
Yeah. That's well said. What did you think about this? I thought this was something I want to get you guys take on. Nadal beat Pedro Cachin in 3 sets. And then I kind of know where you guys are going to go, but at the net, not like afterwards in the locker room, at the net while they're shaking hands and like kind of hugging, Cachin asked Nadal, "Hey, can I get one of your shirts as like a souvenir?" You know, kind of like the old jersey swap kind of thing that NFL or soccer players do. It was kind of like weird the way he did it. He did it like at the handshake, not maybe like off to the side or something like that. And Nadal kind of was like, yeah, sure. And like goes over.
It was a close match, right? It was
three sets, 6-3 in the third.
The guy was,
huge moments, probably one of his idols. And I get it, but it just seemed like weird. Like
he was never going to win that match.
He's never going to win that match. That's what I would say.
That's what I was wondering too.
Yeah. So Nadal was happy. He wants to play 100 guys like that.
Right. Yeah. Well, I feel like there's been a lot of that kind of like went on during the Big Four, where there'd be guys who almost would be rather, get a picture with him at the net than like beat the guy. It's like he's one of the legends or something.
Yeah. Well,
seems different though than when you played. I feel like people wanted to come and like beat you or Mac or Borg, whoever was the young up and coming, not like.
That's true.
They it seems like, back in the day, they would rather beat me or Borg or Mac than win the tournament.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
We called those guys stoppers.
Spoiler stopper.
They would
play one great match.
They'd keep Borg from winning the tournament.
Yeah.
And then they'd be so excited about it, then they'd...
Right, or be worn out from having to go 3 or 5 sets.
Lose to anybody. They lose to anybody afterwards.
Right.
Well,
what do you guys think about Rublev? This is a good run for Rublev.
Yeah.
And remember, we talked earlier in the year, he got defaulted
for
that drama in Dubai.
Right. Little drama, but...
God forbid.
That had some people talking.
Well, now we talk about
it. We talk about it.
We can reference back to.
Something might be good.
Yeah.
But you know what's great? I mean, look at the last 4 or 5 weeks, 5 or 6 weeks. the resurgence of some of the players.
Right.
You know, Rublev's won.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tsitsipas has won. He right. won. He won in Monte Carlo. Then was in the finals of Barcelona. He right. had been through some struggles.
Fell out of the top yeah. 10.
Out of the top 10.
Rude had fallen out of the top 10.
Yeah. Rude. Dimitrov.
Demi.
Yeah. Yep. That you know was more on hard courts, I guess, and had some success on the clay. But
yep. Felix. I mean, even though he didn't really pick up a lot of wins, this is good for him.
Right.
He fell out of the top 30, 35.
Talk about confidence all the time, Brett.
That's yep. everything.
Yeah. And even though you know he might have you know had a little lighter load to get to the finals, that still
right.
puts him in the final.
He might use this to just you know. Do well the rest of the year.
And you certainly know he's got the talent.
Yeah.
He's got talent. He's a
six in the
all-around player.
Yeah. Career high is six.
Talking about confidence, we're talking about this kid I watched, and you guys, I don't know if you've followed him. I'd never seen him play before. Draper.
Yep, Jack Draper.
Tall, lefty, British or Australian.
British.
He loses to Fritz after being up a set, and then he's beating him in every way, and then Fritz gutted him out, kind of like stayed with him.
You're watching more tennis than you let on.
I had the surgery on my shoulder.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, so this guy has a lot of talent. I don't know if he has the head for tennis. I definitely think the verdict's out on his head, on his game. He's got a huge lefty serve, moves great, big forehand, good two-hander. There's no weakness in his game, really. It's just his mind.
Can you teach that?
No, you can't. That's why we're bringing it up. Can you teach a kid like this confidence? I would say, if I was going to say the All England Tennis Federation of the UK, hire Jimmy Connors, you know, this guy will be in the top 10 in 6 months. If you could teach, because if confidence is teachable, because he's got the game.
You're too kind, Smith.
Yeah, and he's got the game to improve him. And you see very few guys with this kind of talent. There are some. There's probably four or five others that I haven't seen that have this big kind of huge game type of talent. But anyway.
Made the finals at Adelaide. Lost to Lehechka in three earlier this year. And then made the semis of Acapulco.
Correct. And he clay lost, or cement?
So that's cement. And he lost to, he had to retire to Dimenauer. Retired 4-love down in the third.
Okay.
I feel like he could have taken his medicine. Well,
mentally, I think mentally he's not there. He's not there. He's not even.
Yeah, he's young still, right? I think he's like 22 or 3.
And then he needs, you know, he's blows a fuse, it looks like. But anyway, so that was interesting to watch him play.
He's 22.
22. He's got plenty
of time.
Still
young.
But you know,
6'4". I mean, he's a big kid. You're right. He's got big game. Being lefty, that's a good advantage for him.
Big game. But mentally, you know, it's hard to change mental illness or whatever you want to call it. Mental. You know, you either have it or you don't mentally lie.
Right.
90% of the time, you know.
So that's actually a good point, Spence.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what is it that you know some guys have that are willing to do whatever it takes out there, you know, to stay in and to give it your all and to, you know, just work through no matter what it is, you know.
Well, certain guys have it that the other guy. I think looking at all the guys I've seen play, everybody has a different reason, you know what I mean? You did it. You weren't going to lose. You wanted to be number one in the world and that was it. You didn't want to lose to anybody. You always wanted to beat everybody every time you went on the court. And you always did your best. My dad, Gonzalez, even Bobby Riggs. I've seen guys, you know, always played their best on the biggest points. Generally, like 99% of the time, you're never going to get a gift. You have to play. To beat him when he was playing, you had to play your best on the big points. Not only did you have to play out of your mind, and then you had to, then if he was able to stop you on the big points, he's going to end up beating you in the third set 90% of the time. Guy like Federer, super talent, maybe didn't even need to do that. He just goes over you, rolls over you. Maybe Sampras rolls over you. But look at Nadal. He's another one. Just he's going to grind you down. Every time you need a big point from him, you have to do something unbelievable. And Djokovic showed you he could. He's one of the few guys that comes through, even though he has his ups and downs compared to like Nadal was like pretty steady all the way through. You were always pretty steady. You never had like play terrible and then play good. You wouldn't like choke terribly and then come back. Djokovic seems he is capable of doing that at times. You know, serve two doubles at 30 all when he's serving for match and then come back and win in five.
Right.
You know, very few guys do that. But I think it's a big difference. I would call the real champions that I've seen, and I mean real champions, are the guys that play better than they can on the big points and in the big matches.
Yeah.
So Jimmy, a guy might go play, you know, so let's say somebody in practice, Dick Stockton, and Dick Stockton takes a set. If they're in the semis of the tournament, Dick Stockton's going to have trouble getting past four all. And so that's an example of what I think the real champions do. They just, you can't beat them. They wear you down when you're just, and you might have more talent than the guy. You might be faster than Connors or better serve than Connors. But he's going to make you return and hit that shot every time at 30 all.
In today's times with the heavy balls and that would seem to be a benefit to the guys
that are grinders. I think, and they've turned it into a clay game. So on the whole, most of these guys are grinders. We have, fortunately, Sinner coming up with the big game, and you have this Alcaraz who's like a maestro, kind of like a nasty, he can do a lot of,
he seems raw still.
He can drop, he has feel, he has all these,
right.
He's looping the ball in, but in the end, can he withstand balls hitting this close to the baseline for, I don't know, on a faster court? It looks like he isn't. Madrid, he won Wimbledon, but Djokovic didn't hit a serve well in the fifth.
And he still won.
I mean, Sinner, I think, should be a better grass court player, but I don't know. But anyway.
He will. I feel like, you said he lost that match to Joker, and then last year he went pretty deep. I feel like he lost to, I think, Tsitsi.
And he's been there now again. He's been in the finals of a Grand Slam and won one. And he's done the same on clay. And he's, here we go again with confidence. But before, being put in that position, maybe he wasn't ready for it.
You're only ready once you've had a chance to do it, too.
But you got to build a guy's confidence.
Not many guys win their first times in those positions. And then, those guys usually end up being kind of the greats anyway. The guys who win their first Grand Slam final or the Masters 1000.
But even then, everybody has confidence issues. I think even the champs have it. I think the key is to cycle the coaches that haven't done anything, that these medium guys have a tennis academy that were never big, never experienced real matches. They don't impart confidence. Guys like Jimmy, guys who really played the circuit,
been there
and have been there, they impart confidence. And I think that's the psychological edge that's more than just the coaching of the game. That's not there for a lot of these kids, maybe.
Yeah.
Like, well, who, I don't know who Draper's coach is. Get somebody who can give him confidence and make him think he's better than he is.
Yes.
And then he's going to win.
That's a good point.
Think he's better than he is. And then all of a sudden he's going to win and he's going to realize, shit, he really is that good.
Right.
Or he could be
that
good.
You have to have that super belief in yourself.
Yeah.
Even if it sounds absurd to everyone around you.
Right.
Even if it's not real.
Even if it's not real.
True.
You got to fake it till you make it. Right. But it seems like the modern game is kind of split between two things. You just said a lot of them are grinders. It feels like a lot of them are grinders trying to get one more ball in play. And then the other half is these high risk, red line players who are just going for it. Big shots. Like the final, Sabalenka and Iga.
Mm-hmm.
Great match, three sets. Swiatek wins, beats Sabby. Sabby won here last year.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like that's a good example where, in the finals of the U.S. Open against Goff.
Yeah.
Remember, Goff just kind of kept getting another ball back, looping another giving her a tough overhead.
Right.
And Sabby kind of started making the errors.
Melted down, no confidence.
And it seems like there's a lot of matchups like that where, someone's Sabby's got huge power off both wings in her serve. And when she's firing, she just, takes the racket out of your hand.
Yeah.
But you see a lot of that, right? Where it seems like there's kind of two styles.
Well, the girls about, I don't know, years ago, I guess it was, who was the girl quit with a great backhand one-hander? And
Hennin.
And there was a lot of great matchups in the girls that when the guys were all playing like Root, and I actually, Serena, Venus, attacking, coming in behind balls. It was actually, I watched some women's matches I liked better than men's.
Totally.
And I'm not following women's tennis enough now, but... that's what I hope we're moving away from. We're moving away from 2 feet behind the baseline rallies because I think it's boring.
Two would be nice.
Okay. Yeah, two's
hugging the baseline now.
That's right.
Yeah. I think there's hope, though, with guys like Alcaraz and Sinner and
definitely.
And even this guy, Draper, if he was to start moving up with his game and some of these other guys,
Yeah. Yeah. There's other guys. But yeah, I was happy to see Sabby have a good run. Like you said, she's had a little dip since Australia.
Yeah.
So it was good to see her, back in there. And in Iga's, it seems like the WTA has kind of four players that are the top. You got Iga, Sabi, Rybakina, and Coco, kind of like right there.
Coco's a great athlete.
Yeah. I mean, she's got potential, like, you know, she can win any tournament.
I think her game's as good
in.
As it's going to get. I think she's a great competitor. Yeah. I think she's a better competitor than almost any American girl, maybe any American boy, man play.
I mean, she can, her movement and, like, her athleticism is off the charts, you know. And I feel like she can get better. You see,
young still.
Yeah. She's like anybody 20. Gets a little better. You're going to get a little better, but it's going to
get wait, wait, wait. Draper is young at 22, but Coco's capped out at 20?
I look at their game. Sinner can improve. Alcaraz can still improve, too. Not everybody can improve. Depends on how you hit the ball and all that, too. It's not just – there's other things. Can Fritz improve from here, in your opinion?
Sure. Yeah, I guess. I mean, he's kind of
– What's going to get better?
This net game, I feel like coming forward, like inside the court game.
He's got to get there. Yeah. He's got to get there
first.
He's
got to want to get there. Right.
He's got a great game. He's got if he could improve inside the court and his movement. Not everybody can improve movement. It's athletic genetics things.
And, yeah, the footwork. Sometimes you just don't have the footwork. You know? Like,
here's a guy who's a great competitor. He never gives you anything. He competes extremely well. I watched him play as a junior.
Who's this?
Fritz. Yeah. Fritz, all a really good competitor.
Yeah.
Great kid.
Well, he's become a lot better than I thought he was going to be.
Oh, really? Yeah.
I think a lot of people that I work with, you know, when he came up, we didn't know. And, like, you know, like, his family had played tennis and all this stuff. But then, you know, he made top 10.
No.
That's legit, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now that he's where he is a question, what can he do for me?
What does he do? Does he stay here or does
Well, then we're forgetting Shelton. He's a tremendous.
What do you think about Shelton?
Tremendous talent. And he gets away with. He does what these other guys say. He floats into the middle on his serve. When he's up 30 love, he comes into the middle, and he's ready to come in.
Right.
He's like floaty. He's a float, you know, like the old the guy.
He's an attacker.
He's one of the only guys.
Yeah.
He's got a big forehand. He's got a little bit. He cocks the forehand in the night. I like his whole game. I think he's serving huge. He's got big.
One on clay.
He's steadier. He's only going to get better. He's a top 10 player. No question.
And he's young.
Yeah, he's young. There's my... So
he's got the most potential out of the American men?
Oh, no question.
Right.
Not even moat.
He seems like he's similar to Alcaraz, where they're raw. Like, they try and do a lot of things that maybe other people don't have the guts to, or try tactics, or, hey, I'm going to try and...
But if we have the old courts...
Yeah.
He wins Wimbledon again.
Right.
Yeah.
Shelton,
with that serve.
Yeah, he's a beast.
And he can volley.
Lefty.
And he's good enough off the ground. He's got a big forehand.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Yeah, he's fun to watch.
Yeah.
And his dad's been around too.
Yeah,
by the way.
You played him.
Yeah.
Played him a couple times. Right. I think Brian Shelton.
And knows what it's like.
Yeah, he's well coached.
Yeah. He coached him at Florida. He was the Florida coach. He went there, and then when he graduated or when he left.
Makes you pass him on easy points. Yeah. He's not going to sit out there and rally with you.
I like that he's not afraid to get passed. Some of these people, like, their ego takes a hit. I got passed. I'm not coming in again.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, yeah, and usually that's after the second time they get passed, and they, you know. But sometimes I was always, you know, told growing up, there's two things, and you got to learn them yourself: greed and fear.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, you got to know when to be a little greedy,
right?
And maybe go for a little more when you have to, and then you got to know when it's, you know, but to have no fear. You know, to go for your shots, you know.
Yeah. So Shelton seems like he doesn't have fear.
Yeah, I like that.
130 mile an hour, sir.
Yeah. He'll hit two of them. You know what I mean? Just go boom, boom.
Boom, boom, and then attack.
Right.
I mean, you know.
Yeah, it's good to see a young kid with that attitude.
Yeah.
I like that he has some attitude.
Yeah.
Remember he had the back and forth with Djokovic at the Open, where the cell phone or the hanging up celebration. Yeah. But I like that. Like, you know, whatever it is, at least, hey, man, he's not backing down. He's young. He's going up against the best player maybe ever.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, going at it with him, you know, respect.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep, I like it.
What do you think? We had Holger Rune. Did you listen to our Holger Rune episode in December?
No, you had him on there.
Yeah, we had him on.
Oh, wow. He's a
what do you like about him?
Athlete.
What do you think about him?
He hits the ball early. He can come in. He can volley. He looks like one of the few guys that could end up being a volleyer from moving in, that I've seen in a long time. Like a...
Sneaking in.
Right. Like, he's a better all-around player than a rafter, like groundstroke-wise.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got he needs to learn. He needs to be coached. That's coaching. And then his serve is good. It could be... I mean, I don't necessarily like his service motion that much, but I think he could definitely be top five, top 10 player.
He had Becker. Becker yeah, was, Becker. What, oh, was in his camp
Boris,
for a while.
Well, yeah. Boris is good.
But they stopped, and then now he's back with Martoglu.
Well, I don't know. He dropped shots down love 30 on his serve from behind the baseline.
Yeah, like the tactics.
Down 3-4. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure he's changing that. He's got a great attitude on the court. I think I love the way he plays. I mean, he's got a forehand, too. He's got everything.
Yeah, you're right, though. The serve. I feel like he knows he works on the serve.
Yeah.
That there's like room
he could definitely, I think he's the, you know, fifth or sixth best player he should be, you know, at least.
Seems like he's trying to get it all figured out, too.
I think he needs to win. That's the problem for him. He needs that. Get Jimbo to coach him, Jimbo to coach Draper.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for candidates isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is the matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. So ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agreed Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. The one thing I love about Indeed is that it makes it so easy to hire because everything is all in one place. I don't have to go around searching for different things on different websites. Indeed's got me covered. Also, it helps it get done fast. That's the best part, too. If you're looking to get help with your company and hiring, Indeed's got your back. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Here's my favorite part, guys. Listeners of this show, Advantage Connors, get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your job more visibility at Indeed.com/Connors. That's right. All you got to do is go to Indeed.com/Connors right now and support our show, Advantage Connors, by saying you heard it here on this podcast. Helps us a lot. Just go to Indeed.com/Connors. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. All right, let's get back to the show.
What do you think about going to Rome? Did you ever play Rome?
I did.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I was very young, when I first started, like 72, 73, and then I didn't go for a while because, you know, even though, and then I didn't play the French, you know, for like
forever.
6 or 7 years. And so that I didn't even go to the clay. Yeah. You know, I kind of, you know, tried to
bailed.
Figure out. Yeah.
You didn't have to. You didn't have to.
Well, there was a lot of clay in the U.S. too, right?
Hard true.
Right, but there was like a clay season, like kind of.
Right, after after Wimbledon.
After Wimbledon, right. Okay.
But I would go over and I'd play a tournament, a little small tournament before Queens, and I'd play Queens, and then a week of practice, and then Wimbledon, and then come back over. But Rome, and then I played Rome at in the late 80s, when you're getting older and you're playing on that surface like that, that wasn't my best anyway.
Yeah, it's tough.
Yeah, it was brutal.
So they did 1 year. I think I don't think you played the French. They put tree torn balls. I don't know if you ever.
Yeah.
They had like pressureless balls. Every single American was out in the first round. I mean, it was like.
So they had no pressure.
It was like they were dead, like dead balls. So your serve did nothing.
Yeah.
And your ground strokes did nothing. So it was a rallying, running down. Sliding kind of game. And
right.
There was a guy named some other French guys were the worst looking game you've seen in your life. And they're in the semis, round to 60.
Patrick Poissy.
He was a decent player. I mean, he was a good player. But it was just, the playing those tournaments for Americans was, in those days, nobody did it. Because the only big, big tournament was the French.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it was always won by European generally. I mean, always.
Yeah. The interesting thing with all the injury talk, and then you said about the guys coming back with Tsitsi and those guys, it seems like with so many injuries now, with guys pulling out and retiring, that there's going to be a lot more like variety of winners, don't you think? Like if this, so many guys are pulling out.
Well,
like
a lot younger guys, maybe.
Yeah. Given other
there's
guys.
Maybe not going to be so much domination. Guys not winning like six, seven
like
tournaments
the last 15 years.
Yeah, not going to be like that.
Right. You know, a lot of young guys coming up that, you know, that have a chance to, you know, to make a move, to make a reputation and a name for themselves, to, you know, to be able to now, that's necessary to be able to get into more tournaments.
Right.
You know, to have a good result. And especially like we talked last time, you know, thinking about a totally different circuit with the four right. Grand Slams and, you know, 10 of the bigger 1,000 yeah. tournaments.
What do you think about that? I want to get your take on the Saudi investment and all the involvement that they're, you know, doing with tennis.
I think, one, if for American tennis players, we need more tournaments, okay? You need to have...
In America,
yeah. we need more tournaments, and we need a way for these guys who are in college and that go to college and are good players there, they're going to want to play pro circuit. There has to be a way for guys who go to college then can go onto the pro circuit. So America has to create tournaments for Americans to get points. These Europeans, that's what they do. They've got a million tournaments over there. All these guys do is play tennis. In America, you know, I mean, let's look at it realistically. Unless you're a top 20 player, I don't know if you're going to make much money in tennis, right?
Well, yeah. You know, going back at one time, I think they had 28, I might be off one or two somewhere along, like 28 tournaments in the United States.
Yeah.
Wow. You know, and now I don't know if they have eight.
Yeah. I mean, so
you know, or something like that. So
not many.
Yeah.
So I don't know. So the USTA, you have to make to have more tournaments. The guys who put the tournaments on have to be able to make money. That's the story of capitalism.
Right.
So if you can't make money, well, who's going to hold tournaments? So one, they have to figure a structure that lets a promoter put on an event, make money, and get players. So that's one. In America, I don't think. We've gone away from that. We've punished the smaller tournaments. We only have the big tournaments get all the endorsements from the USTA. And then, so that's one. And then two, in Europe, we also have to do more for our players to make it so they can get to a point where they can get into tournaments. Mm-hmm. Like, they got these guys playing these club things in Europe where they play for a Barcelona club and they get paid and they get enough money so they can keep playing tennis. I think America's got problems in terms of we have a bunch of good players right now, Shelton and I guess Fritz.
Paul.
Paul's good. I like his. He's an all-around a hell of an athlete. I just don't see the depth of players coming up. We're not doing enough for them. He went to UCLA. Macro went to Stanford. All these other guys went to USC. They were breeding grounds of players.
Yeah, you're right. It feels like it needs more of like a pipeline. Like
we don't
a
have
system,
breeding
right?
grounds. Yeah, we don't have breeding grounds of where it's fun or exciting for people to go and do it.
Well, they
and,
made
and
it,
affordable.
And they made it so tough on them to be able to.
Well, it's so expensive to try and become a pro tennis player.
That's another good point.
With like every other sport, there's like teams and all these things, you know, AAU and all these things that like pick up the tab on a lot of the expenses.
Well, look, how
does
Sheldon get
pro.
In?
He was in Florida.
He went to college.
For 2 years.
And his dad coached him.
Yep.
I mean, what did the USDA do for him? I don't know.
I don't know.
You know, I mean, a guy with this kind of talent, they shouldn't be figuring something out.
And then out of all the countries, I feel like America... We have so many good athletes that then get split into all the sports.
Right.
You know, so we don't target guys that could become a great tennis player and go, hey, man, we'll help you get coaching. We'll help you get equipment or whatever it is, court time, you know. And instead, he's like, well, screw you. I'm going to go to play basketball or baseball or football where they, you know, pay for my outfit. They pay for the equipment. They give me food, like whatever it is, you know.
Yeah. Well, and that way you're traveling with a team and with school and all that. You know, tennis being an individual sport is – most likely, you know, that pressure is put on the family.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, to travel, to get there.
Cost.
You know, cost. You know, and it's not so much the cost, you know, it's the cost of, training, for your son or your daughter. And it's the cost of getting there and the hotel. Yeah. And
Airplane tickets, hotels, everything. Food.
Right.
Yeah, taxis, Ubers.
Yeah. I mean, we're doing better with the women in America than we are with the men.
Right.
I mean, not that we don't have a bunch of good players. We have a bunch of good, but you've got
seems like it's
superstar
been like that for a
women's
while.
Have been higher.
Like the women have been like up there a little more than the men.
Carrying it.
Right. Yeah. Well, what do you think about Saudi Arabia specifically?
I think it's great to have more money in the game if it offers more opportunity to develop more players. In other words, if
so you don't like the idea of like the super tour, where it's just going to be like 10 Masters 1000s in the Grand Slams.
If they have a, they got to have a super qualifying, and they got to have a, they got to put money into
like a minor league or some sort of thing.
They should be forced.
In every tournament, it'll probably be 128 draw. You know, max.
If they could do if they do more tournaments and bigger draws, they solve the problem right there.
Yeah, let more guys in.
If you have 64 in and a qualifying for 8 of those or 10 of those, that's and huge money. You're going to get everybody and their mother trying to play.
Yeah. What do you think about the Masters, some of the Masters going to 2 weeks? Seems like a lot of people don't like it. Yeah. You know, it's like weird with the scheduling and you know, like the top players end up playing, you know, every day. And Monte Carlo wasn't. Monte Carlo was like the old way. And everyone seems to be like yearning for them to be like Monte Carlo. Seems like it's a little weird to have them be 2 weeks and then the slams are 2 weeks.
Are you playing 6 matches or 7 matches?
Six
matches in that week. So you get there's a day off there.
Yeah, day off
if you're making it. So, it's interesting that, Palm Springs is one of them. The Miami tournament is one where
it's 128 with buys. So, like, the top, whatever it is, 32 guys get a buy.
Right. So. Well, still, I mean, that's
a great big tournament.
Yeah.
And a long week.
And men and women at Rome, like Madrid and Rome are both,
it's tours. Interesting, though, a lot of those tournaments back in the old days, Brett, were 3 out of 5.
Yeah.
Or at least, the semis and
the
finals.
The semis and finals were 3 out of 5. So
That was pretty cool. I mean, I must.
We don't need the Saudis, just need 10 Larry Ellisons.
Yeah.
He's done what you see what he did for the World, the sailing championship? He changed the boat. He made it super exciting. He's a, everything he touches in terms of sports, he puts a ton of money, makes them better and better. I mean, so they should get 10 Larry Ellisons doing 10 men's tournaments in America.
Let them run one each one of the majors.
Yeah, but no, I think it's exciting to have Saudi Arabia. Why wouldn't it?
I'm just wondering.
There's more money, more competition. Less competition I don't like. I want to have more opportunity because then you're going to have more new players coming up and more excitement. They could... I don't want to see Sinner and Alcaraz every week. I love them, but I mean, you want to see the new
variety,
Shelton come up. You want to see the Drapers. Or the,
right.
You want to see the new guys come in and have a run. And so I think that would be exciting.
Yeah, it seems weird it being 2 weeks because that's what makes the slams,
So right? Different.
They're two weeks, I don't know, like the flow and the scheduling, and then, the women's final is Saturday, the men's final is Sunday.
The tradition you're talking about.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the slams. Maybe they were 2 weeks because they were 128 draw, men and women, and mixed, and doubles, and women's doubles,
and all that. Yeah.
But they were 2 weeks because they didn't have a roof.
Yeah.
Now they have a roof, so there's...
They're guaranteed to get at least the main courts in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. It's just interesting to see all the changes. It seems like this year or two, 3 years is going to
be
going to look back, and a lot of stuff's going to change.
What do you think? I wanted to ask you about this. What do you think's going to happen with Padel, Pickle? They're taking people. I mean, the Pickle for people over 55, they think it's the greatest thing. They can't play tennis; it's too hard.
Right.
They can't. Padel's harder than Pickle, and they don't want to
it's
do
too
that.
Fast. It goes too fast. Too fast.
So they're loving Pickle. So that's taking a lot of people, I would think.
And you get better.
Yeah.
Quicker.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can get better.
I mean, now they're building these Padel courts everywhere in Florida. They're coming to California. Mm-hmm. I wonder if tennis is going to have a little bit of a challenge. And I'm not saying in terms of events being watched, but in terms of participants, coming forward from here.
I see a lot of, in Santa Barbara, I see a lot of pickleball courts and they are crowded.
And you see tennis with zero.
But that's exactly right. Yeah. The tennis courts aren't crowded at all, but the pickleball courts are. And, the excitement, the yelling, the participation in the pickleball. I mean, I go and I play tennis in the morning
all you hear is dink, 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 dink.
But I mean, they start early too. I mean,
they love it. And the people who play it are like fanatical.
Oh, they're crazy.
Right.
Because it's kind of this new thing, this new sport that people have found and fall in love with. And like you said, being over 50, maybe they can't play faster sports or their body can't cover
or
a whole tennis court.
They're starting it up. Yeah.
And it's a lot of people like playing the doubles. To me, I think the singles is more fun. But the doubles is, you get to play with your buddy and you go play against the team or your friends. But it doesn't translate. translate to television. As much as I hate to say it,
that's good news for tennis.
Yeah, it's not fun to watch pickle because it's very similar. Every point ends up kind of being the same. You know, everyone rushes to the net and they try and get a high ball and then they smack it and then they go back and start again.
Yeah.
Bernard Langer.
Yeah. But I mean, it's been big in Sweden, in Europe. Like, you know, when we go to Sweden, Melina Zlatan Ibrahimovic has a, you know, a paddle.
Paddle.
I
blew my shoulder out at paddle.
That's what you were doing?
Yeah, because you hit a million overheads.
That's the thing that took you down after years of tennis.
Yeah, my shoulder was gone, so I never serve in tennis. So I played pickle for two sets the first day. I must have hit 30 overheads. Then I said, "But geez, my shoulder's stiff. I'm not going to play." Then this guy gets hurt. They say, "You got to play. We need you to play." They hit me. They hit a ball over my head. I went back and kind of tried to flick it from behind my back.
Mm-hmm.
Snap. Oh. So the racket's kind of heavy. You hit a lot over it. The people like it's a
but
fun
it's like
sport.
A tennis ball you use.
It's
don't you?
It's almost like a tennis ball. It's hard to it bounces up very easily. So it's hard to put away. It's more of a slice and angles and chips. It's a good game. It's a good game.
I'd like to say I've never seen it played.
No.
Don't hit any over. Don't play. You're going to ruin your shoulder.
Well, can't you hit it off the walls? And
yeah, off the wall, everything. It's fun.
Yeah, it's fun. I got one for you.
Yeah.
Have you seen the Nasty documentary? We talked about it a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, is it good?
I don't know. I haven't seen it yet. We have to see it.
Yeah.
It looks pretty good.
But there's never been a more colorful.
No.
I mean, he's out there. But he's one of the great. First off, one of the greatest athletes to play tennis, in my opinion. That's my first time I saw him. I went with Jimbo to Rome,
mm-hmm.
and I watched. You know, I'm trying to play. I think it was my second time playing on red clay, and I see him running down balls without sliding. On red clay, just he hits it like he's on cement.
Right.
Nobody played move like this guy on clay ever, and he had an all around game. I mean, it was his mind.
Yeah.
Otherwise, he would have been better than his record.
It's funny how tennis is like that, where it's like so much of how's his mental game.
Yeah.
Where other sports, it's maybe not so much.
Yeah.
You don't have time to maybe think as much or whatever it is.
But that's almost taboo to talk about that now.
Yeah.
Your mental
curious.
Strength and how strong mentally you are and all that. I mean, you know, it's out there. It's a disease, and you know, it happens. But I mean, it's still part of sports and
you still have to think and
life and you know that and. But you know, Nasty, you know, would you know, we talked about this before.
Yeah.
That he's the only guy that when he was on the court, every player that was around was watching him play.
Yeah, played such a cool looking game too.
Yeah. So unique. How long did you travel with him?
I think I played till I played 1 year on the full circuit, but I traveled during college a lot.
Yeah.
So he turned pro after first year of college. And then I kind of went on the summers. So I was there every summer, 72, 73, 74, 75. And then right around 76, I quit.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so you got a few years.
Oh, yeah. I saw him play all his, I saw him beat Borg on hard true at the U.S. Open, sitting on the court virtually. And that was one of the great matches I've ever seen where he's hitting. They played an unbelievable fast tennis on hard true. Mm-hmm. And Jimbo was hitting the ball like so hard that Borg was standing next to him, the ball was going by on ground strokes.
Right.
And people say, oh, nobody hit the ball hard. But, that was a great, I saw him play some of his best matches.
Yeah. So on the off occasion that he would lose.
Yeah.
Would you guys go out and blow off steam when you were traveling together in the early days?
He didn't lose that much.
But also don't answer that.
The joke was he never lost almost.
Right.
In 74, he never lost.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like three times. It's like 96 and 3 or something.
On
like
cement
that.
Or a medium court, holding serve twice a set was an achievement.
Yeah.
We did, Brett. Back then.
Don't want to tell the Digame story?
No. We went to, where else did we go? Sweden. We did a lot of stuff. I mean, we were hanging out with Nasty, we're in London. You know, going to Playboy Club when it was at the height, right?
Yep.
We had our share of Joe Namath.
Yeah.
In Romania with him.
Romania. We went everywhere. Sweden, Stockholm.
Sweden, where'd you guys go?
Stockholm.
What was the name of the place?
Alexander's.
We stayed at the Grand Hotel, but it was called...
I can't remember.
Alexander's was it called?
That's one.
We got in a fight there.
Oh, no.
Remember, some guy said something about Jimmy was going out with Chrissy. He said something.
Oh, no.
You'll be cutting that part out.
then we had where else did we get a fight? Oh my God.
But you know, it was interesting though, Brett, back in the day, you know, we'd play in the stadium, say in Stockholm.
Cafe Opera.
Okay. Right.
It's still there.
And there'd only be one court.
In the whole tournament?
Yeah, you know, maybe two courts during the winter. So, you know, if I might play my match at 9 o'clock at night.
Okay.
You know, so, you know, I go, we play the match, and then, you know, what are you going to do? You got to go find a place to eat.
And we are jet lagged.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we're not. We're
right. You're awake.
Time. Yeah.
You know, so, we'd basically stay up all night and then get up at, and then maybe go over at, you know, 6 or 7 in the morning.
Yeah.
And hit balls for 30 minutes just to
get a sweat.
Indoors, and you get and everybody else is wanting to play on that court.
And then go back and sleep all day.
Yeah. So I'll give you one term. He might not even remember. I remember because he got sick. We fly from California to Stockholm. I think it was Stockholm or Scotland or somebody. You know, it goes from like 80 degrees to like 30. And we're 10-hour time chains or whatever it was. And I think we were playing Feedback, who was not bad. He was getting a lot of balls. He had like 102.
Fever, and
Feedback is playing out of his freaking mind. And it's like you said, every shot he's making, every great shot, he can't miss a ball. It gets to like 4-all, 30-all. The point goes 20 points, 20 balls over, and that was the end of the match. Every time he got close, Jimbo wore him out on just those points. Every other point, the guy looked like you thought he was, you know, Laver or somebody. And he beat him, and that was an interesting match. And then I think you lost to Borg there. I don't even remember. Who knows?
Probably did.
Borg.
Yeah. Was that the first time you guys played? Was that the match Borg talked about when he baited you?
Yeah. We went to his house afterwards.
To Borg's?
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, yeah.
At the first time you played, you went to his house?
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, we did.
Borg, That was Borg wasn't a partier yet. Those days.
Yeah, it was funny because he's a number of years younger than I am. And he was almost like Vitas. Vitas was 3 or 4 years younger than me. Yeah. And when we played the first time, you know, we became friendly then too.
Yeah. Right.
Not only, you know, for practicing or whatever. I mean, you know, everybody kind of peeled off and, you know, Vitas and Borg practice. I practiced with Nasty for 5 minutes when he wanted to.
Do you remember going over there?
Over the years, though, Brett, you know, from Wimbledon to the U.S. Open, you know, and even later on after I started playing the French, you know, we would sit literally in the locker room, you know, 3 feet apart.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and he'd be getting ready, or I'd come in, I'm done. He's getting ready to go play, you know, and you'd see a lot of guys.
Yeah.
You know, and I keep going back and saying that you know, the groundwork was laid, even though, you know, we were competing at such a high level against each other, because once our senior tour came along, it was beyond fun.
Yeah.
You know, because all of that was in the past. So we went back 30 years,
right,
you know, to the first time that we ever met and just resurrected that.
Yeah.
You know,
he was a very nice, he's one of the nicest guys.
Yeah, totally. I mean,
you know, a great guy.
Yeah.
Brad knows, but you know, that's why, you know, getting a lot of those guys to play the senior tour. I remember the very first tournament we had. Yeah. I'm sitting there having a lunch with John Lloyd, and literally within an hour, everybody in the tournament was sitting around the table having lunch, and
pulled up a chair.
Everybody pulled up a chair, and you know, which is what made that tour for 10 years pretty successful.
It must have been cool, too, because knowing that you guys were kind of at the top of tennis for that chunk of time, that even though you guys were like rivals and, you know, wanted to kill each other on court, you were like the only two guys who kind of could share these things.
Yeah.
You know, like you're the guys carrying the sport. You're on all the posters. You're the ones helping sell the TV contracts and you know, big guarantees and all that stuff, and kind of doing it for the first time, you know, because tennis just went pro in 68.
Right.
And then, you know, TV and all that stuff came in the 70s, kind of riding your guys'
back. The first
star,
they're the first new stars of the...
Right.
Yeah,
the new pro era.
Yeah.
But it must have been cool, too, like kind of like, you know, wink, wink, like, this is pretty fun, isn't it, Bjorn?
Yeah.
So I met Bjorn, and I was playing in Australia. There's a circuit in Australia, and he was on it. He's younger, like you said. Jimmy and I are the same age. I think he's three years younger. Mm-hmm. And he was with the Swedish team of guys. There was a guy, Johansson. There was like four of them.
Ove Bengtsson.
And I end up traveling with these guys. This is before Bork's famous. So he's not... He's probably 17.
Yeah, young.
And so we go 4 weeks together, and I became very friendly with him. And he got to the Australian Open, and he plays Phil Dent. This is the fastest grass courts in the history. That ball does not even bounce. And they play a great match, and he loses to Dent, I think. And he was always, you know, he never knew he was... He never had a bad mood in him ever.
Really?
He would never change his attitude on the court.
Never change his attitude.
That's why he was so tough to play.
He's so tough. Never miss a ball. Yeah.
And then you couldn't get almost like mad at him because he's like a nice guy.
You can't get mad at him.
So you can't be like using that to like, you know, motivate you.
I got mad at him a few times.
Get mad at him when he passes you from...
Right. Over and over again.
Passes you with that down the line back.
What did you think when you were traveling with him? Yeah. Were you also traveling with your dad?
No. I was just traveling. So the American...
Like, was Pancho coaching you while you were...
No. I went on my own to Australia. So what happened? So Australian circuit wasn't a great... It was a... Other than the Australian Open, they had one other... serious tournament. Nobody played Australian Open back then.
They just had Sydney.
Nobody played it. I mean, that was Sydney, and then there's Melbourne. Mm-hmm. And but there were four other grass tournaments, and it was a good way to go improve. And so the Swedish team and Borg was just part of it. So he played clay court tournament in middle of nowhere where a cow actually came up to the fence where we're playing. That guy.
Really?
And then it was called Gympie. And then we played Adelaide, Perth, 5-hour flight, Sydney to Perth. So it's like five places, and then it ends with the Australian Open. And
were Gympie, or the cow's name was Gympie?
It was called Gympie. It was an unbelievable. Metrovelli played, Russian, who was a good player.
Yeah.
So you had Metrovelli, Borg, and you had the Australians, and you know.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun, actually.
But see, that goes back to what he was saying earlier, that there was opportunities to play.
Right.
Oh, yeah. So
tours,
I qualified the Australian Open, and I beat a guy named Jonathan Marks. That was 1970, whatever. The next year, he was in the semis of the Australian Open. I'm putting down the Australian Open. But I mean, so...
Right.
I mean, and so to win the Australian... So you got to remember, this other point I'm going to make, everybody talks about how many Grand Slams. Frank Sedgman was my dad's buddy. He was one of the great players of all time. To get Jimbo to come the first time that Jimbo played it twice, I think. Mm-hmm. He won it the first. I went with him. It was like, can we get Jimmy to come? Please, please, please come. How much we have to, you know, guarantee... There was... guarantees. Can I talk about that? Anyway, so he got Jimbo to come, and he comes down, and you know, he won the Australian Open, but just the Australians played it. I think the winners
played it
once. So I mean, if he'd played the Australian Open every time, if Borg played the Australian Open every time, they would have won 10 more Grand Slams to compare to Nadal and these guys.
Fact they didn't play, it was on grass. You guys
and Americans didn't play the French either. A lot of Americans. Not that they'd ever win, because they couldn't. Right, most of the clay. That was the other interesting thing, right? I mean, guys are great on clay. Guys are great all around. Would be grass and cement and indoors. If there could be a guy who's just good on clay and couldn't play on any of those, really.
Right.
Oh, not any, but not be.
There was a few guys who only showed up for the clay court circuit.
Yeah.
Wasn't it funny now that if you learn on clay, it readies you for like the other surfaces.
Everything, right.
Well, because everything is clay.
Right, that's what I mean.
Well, Spencer says that, says it right, that they've taken the game mostly,
it's a grinder.
Europeans and South American style,
So by doing that, you'd have to ask, I mean, did they make it more boring or more exciting? Because they think they made it more exciting because remember they want to get rid of anybody serving big. I think they just went too far.
Right, it's like they went a little too far.
Too far. I mean, courts don't have to be so that nobody goes to net at Wimbledon. Right. The balls don't have to be so, you know, that they're so dead and everybody can end up fluffed up or whatever.
Yeah.
And those two things alone, I'm thinking, you know, although now you get Sinner serving, and so what do you get? 6'4" guys.
That can move. Right.
And that's the future of tennis. 6'4", big time game. That's And those are going to be the guys that...
seems like they're kind of combining those two things, where you're getting like a guy like, quote-unquote, Ivan Isevich, who was big and could serve out of his butt.
Yeah.
But now you're also getting them that can rally and stay back if they need to. Right. And then also come to
and
net.
And the high ball doesn't bug them, that topspin ball, because they're hitting down on through.
Right,
because
they're so tall.
Yeah.
What was it like having him as your best friend and then knowing your dad was coaching him?
That was well. I liked it. Well, you know what?
Like, would you talk to your dad about him and like his game and stuff? And then would you talk to him about your dad?
No, my dad and he talked, and I listened and watched what they did, and his mom too. So they had us. Their strategy was one. The first strategy was what we were talking about: the score, where you are on the court. Second serve returning is coming in more inside. Try and get the guy off the court, you know, come and take advantage, play the score. And then the, I think the other, that was one of the major things that they worked on. And then hitting the ball on the rise, which is totally opposite of Rude or somebody like that. Mm-hmm. And then what my dad's goal was analyze the other guy that he's going to play. No, so this is a really big thing that Sampras used to play Agassi. And he always, when he was down, break point, he served the tee. Agassi never moved over to the tee. And my dad would get tapes of everyone who played Jimbo and say, 30 all, he loves to go down. If he's missed his first serve, he loves to go at this pattern. That's when you get to the level of like Nadal, Djokovic. He would have those kind of insights to help Jimbo, which was fascinating to watch. I mean, and that's what I think. Only the really, really good coaches. And there are obviously some, but I mean, that's what a really good coach. He has to understand. I'm not talking about teaching Jimmy how to hit a backhand or teaching. We're talking about how to win the matches. And I think that was what I got out of being around the two of them. And they had their own thing. I mean, Jimmy picked up this stuff. I was like, I didn't pick it up. I mean, he picked it up in a second. Not everybody did pick it up, by the way.
Yeah.
And that's what I think it catapulted his game. His game was so solid, and he was able to take it quickly and move up as opposed to.
Yeah. Interesting that he was like almost early analytics, early like game tape watching and
but he had percentages. He had the game. You can't just do it without the game.
No. Yeah. But like if you know those things compared to somebody else, you have an advantage.
Breaking down game tape and
all that kind of stuff. So back then without replay machines and tape machines where it's easy to do. You have to put work into like that, you know.
Yeah.
And the one thing that I thought I did pretty well was that if Pancho or my mom would tell me something. I mean, they were telling me that for a reason. They weren't telling me that to hurt me.
Yeah.
They were, you know, and I trusted them, you know, that if you're telling me to do that, that it's going to make me better. You know, so I wasn't afraid to literally go out and play my next match and do that.
Yeah.
Seems like a lot of people are scared to do that.
Yeah.
A lot of like modern people, people in general, because you always go back to what's comfortable and what you know.
Yeah. So that's a natural tendency. Like, you coached Roddick, who's a hell of a player. I mean, he had to change his attitude on coming in a little bit and doing some things. And it's hard to do that. And then they do it on the wrong point, or they do it.
They try to force it.
They force it or whatever. And, but you have to get comfortable with all that sort of thing. And, he did. And I think it makes you a champion sooner if you can know how to, like, you got this kid Rune. Mm-hmm. Why are you 4-all on the 3-4 on the third drop shotting from behind the baseline when you're down 15 left? You got to have
situational awareness.
Jimmy, he won't do that. He's never going to do that. Mm-hmm. Never going to happen.
That seems like what Djokovic has become so good. Because you might watch Djokovic and think like, wow, he doesn't overpower you. Yeah. But he is always playing like the percentages.
He plays very similar to Djokovic.
You know what I mean? He's always like, where should I go? Forehand, backhand? Well, 54% says forehand. He's going to go there. You know what I mean? It seems like he plays the numbers.
He moves you at that 90% ball. You know, he hits you deep, backboard. And he works you over with a deeper ball than these guys.
Yeah. But he's interesting because he doesn't overpower you. You know, like Fed could overpower you. Nadal at times would overpower you with his, you know, strength and his, but you know. But Djokovic is just, he's a little different, but he still dominates in the same way that those guys did.
Right.
You know, so.
Well, I mean, that's the such a good thing about individual sports is you pick your own poison.
Styles.
Yeah. And what fits your game. You know, like, you know, at the beginning, you know, I was asked, you know, who was my heroes?
Yeah.
you know, I didn't have any heroes, but I certainly liked everybody's game where I could pick something
that you liked,
that I liked. And that's what talking to his dad was so good about, you know, because, you know, going back, you know, with Laver or Rosewall or, you know, those guys that, you know, and then I kind of got a little feel for it myself, you know, so that I could help myself a little bit, but still that outside influence was big for
so
me.
So my dad, like, so Gonzalez is going to play Laver. Gonzalez is 38, 39, smoking pack a day, retired, and he gets to the finals of this thing in Vegas. And my dad always told him you can attack his second serve. The same kind of thing. You attack his second serve, come in behind him. If you're up, if you get to 30, all I want you coming in behind, volley his volley. And that's how he beat him. Huge points. He came in behind. Laver doesn't have a huge serve. He has a good serve. I mean, he has a good serve at best. Okay, doesn't have a bad serve, but he has a serve, an adequate serve. Everything else he has is unbelievable. How does a guy 10 years older than him beat him? Because he had the perfect game to beat, but he did the right. He outthought him.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Let's do a little fun experiment. Yeah. It's 1971 or two.
Yeah.
You guys are sitting in the hotel room. Build me your prototypical player. Like you said, I like this from this guy and this from that guy. Break it down. Tell me who at that time you were like looking up to and wanted to like copy. Whose footwork, whose forehand, whose backhand.
Well, I'd already been in California for 3 years.
Or whatever. Set 1970.
No. Like just it's a perfect time because I've been here already. And I had been with his dad, you know, for a couple of years already. And then certainly, you know, sitting at the Beverly Hills Tennis Club and hitting with Spencer, and then the next thing you know, Pancho Gonzalez is hitting with him.
Yeah, right.
You know, so I'm sitting watching that.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm not 6'3". You know, so what am I going to get out of Gonzalez?
Yeah, Jimbo got it. Picked everybody's brain.
Yeah.
Right.
And
what did you get from Gonzalez?
Played doubles with them. They learned a lot, probably. Yeah.
Learned a lot just hanging around. I like just hanging around his dad and Gonzalez and guys like that because, I keep saying it, I was a sponge, but I was a good listener. Yeah. I can't listen at all anymore. you know, but back then I was a good listener. So around his dad, his and that's the reason your grandma.
Yeah.
Gave me to his dad was because he took the ball in the rise and he was moved forward and we were about the same size and you know the way he would sneak in and take the ball out of the air and do things that the opponent never expected
surprise him
and that today you Gonzalez, wouldn't do they don't come in on you like they did
Gonzalez I loved his attitude
he was
ruthless he was brutal but his mind towards his game. And what he wanted to do and how he wanted to do it, it was solid.
He comes to Jimbo. I've never forgot that. You're due to play Edberg. I don't know where it was. And he goes, oh, that's routine for you, Jimbo. Edberg is a great player. He goes, but you always, at this point, you always beat Edberg, okay? I mean.
You were like 3-0 against Edberg in slams.
Never lost in a slam. And my dad's always like, well, he's got Edberg now. He's talking to him. He goes, oh, that's routine. Who's he got next? Right to Jimbo. That's like, you know, like a first round.
That's funny.
But the guy was, and he was, so, oh, they're doing a documentary on my dad and Pancho Gonzalez called The Two Ponchos. A guy who did Ash's documentary, Rex Miller. And this Gaspar Gonzalez, who's a documentarian out of Yale.
Did they interview for it?
They're just making the agreements right now. I don't, you know, so maybe it doesn't get financed or what, but I think... Yeah.
That would be pretty cool,
though. It'd be cool. Yeah. And then...
It'd be fun to see that.
Yeah.
They're making a lot of documentaries. The Nasty, the VJ one, the Dash one.
Yeah.
They're doing one on Stan Smith that just came out with the shoes and stuff. Yeah. So
it's an overkill.
it's a little. I think this is more of a like on the era. It's not really them as much. But yeah. So like I watched my dad teach Stan Smith from the age of. I was 12. I watched him teach him from the age of 15.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, so when Jimbo came along, my dad was very excited. That's all I can tell you.
Yeah,
he knew he could be. You know, Stan Smith was number one in the world. We gave him number one in the world. My dad taught him most of it. He will tell you.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was a smart player.
Stan?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Big server, but he played the percentages really well.
Yeah. My favorite clip of your dad is on his favorite match. My favorite win of his is over Borg.
Yeah.
And
which one?
U.S. Open at 76.
Because it's on, was there. You know,
clay.
That was
it's not red clay, but it's clay. Match. And the cutaways of your dad is like standing up going, yes, come on, baby.
But it was like baby. That kind of match. It was a slug out.
Yeah. But like it's great. You see how much he cares and how passionate he is.
But I'm telling you, Jimbo's hitting the ball. Borg's standing here going like this for a backhand and the ball's by him.
Yeah.
And it's here.
Yeah.
On clay. That's how hard they were hitting the shit. That was such a great tennis match. I wish is there any tape of that?
Oh, yeah. I'm sure there is. Yeah. We could find it somewhere.
Probably got I'm sure my mom probably, had it put away someplace. You know, she kept...
Labor him in the challenge match because the camera was down low. You can really see how big the ball was really going. You know, the problem with most of these older matches is their camera's up above,
too high.
Shooting down.
Yeah.
On this match, you can... So Jimbo's up. I think you won the first set on Labor pretty easy. Labor gets better. He's getting better and better and better.
You said Labor didn't have a hard serve. I watched those matches. He's hitting it pretty hard on that fat flat.
Okay, but my dad's concept was you can hurt him up. That's
okay.
But he returned. You got to remember,
right?
So if you're talking a normal guy, but if you got a monster return, that isn't the same as trying to return Gonzalez. Is acing you twice a game?
Yeah,
he aced you twice a game, and he moved, and he could get in on top of you.
Yeah,
and the ball didn't bounce.
The good thing when I came out to California and came on these fast courts in California was that I learned to be aggressive and to the word now on the return is to be neutral. I never wanted to be neutral.
Yeah,
I wanted to to start the point and to be aggressive and be on top as quick as I could.
Right.
Yeah. And, it didn't work all the time, but still
that's the way Djokovic beats Nadal.
That was my attitude.
Well, I think most guys go, well, they're serving so hard. Like I can only get to neutral, but not if you stand up and take the ball early. Right.
Especially like on the second serve.
Right.
But so, Nadal, since the old man would say, my dad, Nadal's the greatest player who neither had a great serve or a great return. The greatest player ever to play the game. In other words, he puts the ball in play on the return, and he puts the ball in play on the serve.
Mm-hmm.
But once you're in the point with him, if you don't hurt him, he pulls you out. You're out of the point.
Yeah, you're done.
The only guy that did give him the trouble, Djokovic, and that's the only guy that plays like him, like Jimmy.
Right.
So that is why, and they've had those war matches. And I got to hand it to Djokovic. He beat him on those courts, the slow court with the high bouncing ball. With the deep game, and it's amazing. Some of those matches are where they're hitting the ball 1 inch from the line. At least Nadal is getting pressured. That's the only way you can beat Nadal.
All right.
Yeah. At those days. I mean.
Yeah. Well, I have a question from David Hopkinson.
Okay.
All right, David.
What made Jimmy go to the double-fisted backhand? I remember reading Spencer's dad's book, helped your dad to make that shot a real threat. Wasn't Segura double-fisted on both wings? No, he was only
forehand.
On forehand, right, yeah.
Well,
so did you go to the two-hander because you were little and the racket was heavy?
Right.
You did,
exactly.
Right? That reminds me of John Daly. You know how Daly takes far past parallel? Yeah. He always says that his first set of clubs was like a heavy, too big for him. And so, like, when he would swing, it was heavy, so it would go past parallel. So it was like, that's just how he had to do it.
My mom and grandma, they wanted to cut the racket down.
Yeah.
And
make it shorter.
And lighter.
Lighter, yeah.
And Pop said no.
That's smart.
Yeah, he says no. He says, he's going to have to play with that racket eventually. So let's see how he handles it. You know, so that's why I started playing with two hands because I couldn't hold it on that one side with just the one hand and hit a one-handed backhand. But
your dad righty?
His different story.
Two-handed forehand was
two-handed backhand, right?
He could hit one hand too, but he had rickets and all these other things that he had no, they gave him a racket out of a garbage can. It was too heavy. So he played against a wall and he could play with two. And then it developed from there. But I want to say, in my opinion, there's the two-handed backhand is by far the best shot for return a serve. Everybody returns well with two hands, and one hand's very few guys return great off first serve return.
Mm-hmm.
Second serve maybe, I don't. So I think you got to have both today. I think you got to have a two-hander, and it's got to be great because everybody has a good two-hander, and then you got to have a slice one-hander.
That's big now. It seems like.
But that's everything. That's called. You don't need more than that.
Right.
Throw me in another question.
Let's see what we got. Hang on here.
Yeah.
You've been, are you up to date on everything? You've had a good little break away from everything. You're catching up in a hurry.
Yep, I got it. Let's see. This talks about T2000. The T2000 had a very small sweet spot, but the trampoline effect achieved through the torque, a unique string pattern created lots of power. There's not really a question there.
Well, but he's right.
Yeah.
He's right. I mean, if you didn't hit the ball right in the center of those of the four strings that met, you couldn't run it around the rim. But the string.
So was it like a shank? If you almost like a mishit,
the ball would go anywhere. but the stringing pattern and with the wood rackets, how you go in and out of the holes at the top and everything. This was wiring across the top. It went around the top, but you'd strung it from the inside of the racket. So, you know, the reason why a lot of the players at the time, they tried it, but they couldn't control it.
Right, most of them.
Yeah, the racket was too fast, and the reason being because you had to know how to string it. And two mom, my grandma strung that with a picking and awl.
An older woman in Illinois.
But she also was
knew how to take a French racket.
Right.
A French invention racket that was like ahead of its time. And she was the one who knew how to string it.
She, you know, because in the day, that's what you would, you stick the pick in the string and then you pull it, on a wood racket so the string wouldn't move. But she did that with this racket. How she did it, I'd never know. But she's the one who figured out the best way for me to play with it to fit my game, the tension of it. You know, everybody was trying to string it way too tight or not tight enough.
Right.
Or, you know, there was that little happy medium in there where the ball would just, you know, just catapult off that racket.
But you had to have a lot of control. A lot of control. I mean, not everybody.
Did playing with that racket made you better? Almost, right? Because you had to be.
How do you think it made your return bigger or made your ball hit harder or what?
Well, it made my timing good. It made my timing really good, to be honest with you, because I didn't swing that racket
like
hard.
Like a baseball player.
The racket was heavy. It was a heavy racket. So, you know, my idea was to get it moving, you know, in the right direction and then let the racket do some of the work for me. That's what your grandma, my mom, always told me. Says the racket is like an extension of your arm. Let that do the work for you. Don't you...
Yeah. That's key.
Do all the manipulating and all that. Right. So
today it's a difference.
Yeah,
they're using the forearm.
Yeah, that's why playing today with this equipment. That's why I don't use a modern day racket.
Hurt your arm.
Right.
I couldn't do it.
Right.
I think that's interesting because he played. So you got to remember, guys are coming in on him serving. There was a lot of good servers. Tanner, remember Tanner?
Oh yeah.
The guys you don't even know, right? Mm-hmm. That Sid Ball from Australia. Yeah. I mean, guys are serving 115, but it's nothing. But he's hitting. They're having trouble getting to 30 all. That's how good his return. So now they got to go back. How do you play him then? You got to stay back. So you're better off playing him. You'll lose slower, as my dad would say. You want to lose slower, stay back.
Take your time.
You want to lose fast, go in.
Right.
When his dad, when I was playing, Brad, especially at the U.S. Open, you're right down on the court, and even when it went to Flushing Meadows.
Yeah.
He would sit in the box, you know, right behind the court.
Yeah,
and you know, it's some crazy times in some matches. Like I was down 5-3 in the fifth to Panada, in 78, and I'm walking back, and some of the things he would say to me, you know,
he's going to get his mind off it. We can't repeat
to
him,
keep
probably.
You loose.
And he says, don't look up, Jimbo, but. You know, but his timing was so good. You know, when to say it, when not to say it, you know, what to say.
When you needed something.
When I needed it.
Okay, now I'm going to get in trouble. But I watch McEnroe, you know, every time he lost, it was nothing to do with the other guy playing well. It was just, he's way better than him. You know, that's a defense mechanism, you know, he never believed anybody was better than him ever. And that's what kept him thinking the way he thinks. Jimmy did it on his own confidence, but there's still tricks, even with a champion, to keep him always not, you know, the guy's got you 5-3 in the fifth. What the fuck? The guy's got a huge serve.
He's
right?
a great player.
He's a hell. I mean, the guy's, Fanato is a super dangerous, hell of a tennis player. You know, keep thinking you're better than him. How do you do that? You know, he's beating the crap out of you.
You still have to have that.
You have
that
to
confidence.
Still have to have that. that it might be fake or it might be real, but whatever, you need it.
All right.
Yeah.
There's no receipts afterwards. If it's real or fake, as long as it works.
I mean, Muhammad Ali, I'm the greatest ever, you know, how he was.
Yep.
No one ever was any good compared to him.
No. He was the man. I'm a big Ali
he's
guy.
He's the great. I'm the biggest Ali. Fan of him. He's my greatest athlete.
Yeah, me too. I love him.
Yeah.
One last thing before we go to non-Boncat. We got 30 minutes till Tony's going to open it up for us.
Yeah. Perfect.
We got some chicken balls ready to go.
Okay.
Let's just look at the French Open odds. Yeah. I thought this was kind of interesting because Alcaraz is hurt, Sinner's hurt, Nadal's hurt. Here are the odds. Yeah. Alcaraz is the favorite, plus 140.
Yeah.
Then it's Joker, plus 250.
Yeah.
Then you got Sinner, plus 350, Nadal, 5-1, Runa, 8, Tsitsi, 12, Zverev, 14, Ruud, 14, Med, 14. And then it goes up from there to like 30-1. So.
It's
hard to bet.
Ruud he's had success there, hasn't he?
Yeah, Ruud's made the finals twice.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Ruud and Tipsy Ass.
Tsitsi Ass.
The dark ass. Tsitsi. Or the dark horses.
The dark ass. That's funny. Yeah,
those are the two dark horses.
Hard not to put a little bit on Joker.
Joker. He hasn't played.
He hasn't played, but like, who else has? Like, who's going to, you know, beat him? I mean, a lot of the guys are hurt.
Listen, no matter what you say, brother, you just said it right. He's still Djokovic.
Right.
Yeah. He's still won 24,000 Grand Slams, and and has the reputation and the game and everything to go along with it. And it's the French.
Yeah.
It's one of those tournaments that he's going to want to win. You know,
right.
Like Wimbledon or the U.S. Open or the Australian. It's the Grand Slam. And
it's the only reason he's hanging around.
Yeah.
Because he didn't play these last couple tournaments.
Yeah.
You know, he's just hanging around to play the big ones, it seems like.
Right.
So.
You know, and why not?
Why didn't he play? Why hasn't
I'm
he
not sure. I don't know. Like, if it's an injury.
Is he going to play any before the French?
He might be in Rome. I'm not 100%
sure.
Okay,
he needs to be.
I feel like he's got to play Rome just to get a little match play. Yeah. But, you know, he got rid of Ivanišević.
Oh, he's not coaching him?
And then it's like his fitness trainer he's been with for a long time. So he's kind of like cleaned his team out.
It
seems like he's maybe he's figuring that out before he comes back. But I might have to take a little taste of that plus 250.
Well.
There'll be hedge opportunities later.
Later down the road.
You want to hedge once he's in the semis.
Exactly. Yeah, just hedge on the other guy because they'll be a big fave. So.
Yeah.
Spence, anything else you want to talk about?
No, I mean, it's a lot of fun talking about everything. I think we hit a lot of subjects.
A lot of good stuff.
Yeah.
Looking forward to your shoulder getting better.
Yeah, shoulder getting better. I want to
play a little golf.
Let's get Jimbo back in tennis somewhat. He's we got to get him motivated.
He's got a tennis podcast.
I got a tennis
podcast.
I'm in tennis good enough right here.
He knows more
now.
About tennis than these people. All you have to do is write a big check, England Lawn.
Lloyd, talk
to Lloyd. Lloyd should go to the English Lawn Tennis Association and get Draper. We'll
come on, Lloyd.
Write a big check, Johnny. Get that done.
Nice.
Spence, always good being with you. You know, you coming on the podcast is always fun. And listen, we're like brothers. We've been friends since we've been kids.
Yeah,
we sit down and talk like,
pick right back up.
Pick right back up. That's right. But always fun being with you. But I'm down at your neck of the woods
now. Yeah, I'm going to take Bella out for a little walk here. I miss her. I'm going to have to. You know, she's been sleeping up there with her grandpa and grandma.
Right.
So I'm jealous. I've been missing her.
And in the meantime, you can follow me at Jimmy Connors on Twitter. Brett at Brett_Connors. Our podcast ADV Connors, Advantage Connors.
Spence, you on Twitter?
No, I don't on Twitter. I'm on Inura. I'm CEO of Inura. We we prevent migraine headaches and treat migraine headaches with transmagnetic stim. Come to my website.
He's on Instagram. At Spencer Segura on Instagram. Yeah. So you can look him up there. Thanks for joining us, guys. It's been a lot of fun. And let's go to Nambancon and eat some chicken balls.
Right.
Peace.
Great. Fun.
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery.
Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the roaring 20s. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.